This is the 3D Pod, your number one source for 3D printing news, analysis, and insight from 3DPrint.com. Now, here are your hosts, Joris Peels and Maxwell Bogue.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another episode of the 3D Pod. And with us, as always, is Maxwell Bogue. How are you doing, Max?
I'm good, Joris. How are you doing this week?
I'm great. Well, actually, I was about to say I'm great, but so I kind of badly sprained my ankle. So I'm kind of like cooped up in like an Airbnb rather than exploring the city. So I'm kind of like really, annoyed, actually.
It's a shame.
Super annoyed at the world in general. But
it's a shame you don't have a printer that you could use right now to like make a brace for your...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. or do something with orthotics or something. You know?
Yeah, that exactly. That would be good.
If only I knew people that are into orthotics.
If I only knew these things.
Yeah, I know. But a visit to the emergency room, like, was for me, it was always like I felt really lucky, you know, with regards to, like, versus a lot of the other people. So I felt really, like, kind of blessed, actually, in a kind of weird way. But
fair
anyway,
enough.
So generally, like I reflexively said, good mood, but I'm feeling kind of cooped up at the moment. So good to explore through conversation.
Exactly, cooperative exploration through conversation. Who do we have on the 3D Pod today?
So today we've got Dave Dietrich. He is somebody who's been an additive for a very, very long time, engineering much longer, and he started as a mechanical design engineer. He worked as a adjunct professor at the University of Tennessee. He worked at Boeing for 12 years in process and physics engineering and metals fabrication, doing a project in conjunction with Oak Ridge. Then he worked at was an engineering fellow at Honeywell for a long time and became as a consultant. And then he moved over to PADT Inc. And that's a company I really, really, really like. And it's a company that does a lot of like product innovation, product development. They could make you a product, but not just like something silly, maybe, like, but something really complicated, like a medical device or some kind of really complicated instrument. This is a company that'll help you. And also, kind of a weird way, PADT also is a reseller for Ansys and AOS and other equipment and stuff. So they do that at the same time. But that gives them a deep experience in kind of like this kind of, engineering and analysis software, as well as just product design, product development. So I really love PADT. I think it's a really cool firm. So it was a great chance to get to talk to Dave and everything like that. So welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. I'm really honored to be able to hop on this and chat with you guys for a few minutes. I've always had a deep respect for 3dprint.com. I check it every day, like most people in the industry. I think the Additive Manufacturing Strategy Summit, where we chatted, is obviously a really nice venue to be able to kind of, really get a reality check on the industry. So, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to participate in this podcast and, look forward to the discussion.
All right, cool. So Dave, first off, you were an engineer first, right? So you're doing all this mechanical engineering stuff, and all of a sudden, kind of mid-career-ish, kind of, you come in contact with additive. What happened, and what was that like?
Yeah, so I started my career, just actually with a police car ambulance light company where I was designing low-profile light bars way back in the day. This was back when kind of LED technology was kind of coming on the scene. And so I had, a big project where I had to design these really huge injection molding, like lenses for these police car lights. It had to be transparent. These were really large, really complicated tooling that had to be constructed. And so I was fairly fresh out of college at the time. And my role was to be kind of a design engineer to develop this. So I would spend like months on SolidWorks to try to get, the design perfect. And, during this time, I was always kind of wondering, okay, well, we have to actually produce these things at an injection molding company. How can we do this and lower the risk? Because frankly, I was scared out of my mind at that time, given that there was like $130,000 mold tool riding on the line.
And it's like your first project ever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like my first project, right? I'm like, what's going to happen? And my boss was, at the time, he was pretty hard. So he's like, don't screw it up, And so he would review it, but I started looking online, and this was way back in the day, way before additive manufacturing was around. And this was about 2000 and my gosh, it was probably 2003, 2002. And so I found a company online that way out in California, and this was in St. Louis where I was working, and you know, there's this brand new technology called stereolithography, right? And this technology could produce a part, and you know, I could print this part, or they could print this part, they could send it to me, and I could use it as a design verification check tool to put on the actual physical lenses, and you know, burn down an enormous amount of risk because. If any kind of design change or any feature in that lens didn't match appropriately, then I could, you know, make design changes and then send them another one. And, you know, that's how I was introduced to this whole world of rapid prototyping. And so that was a company long ago, Sicon Technologies. I think they're still in California. I reached out to them. So I was really excited about the opportunity because they could print in kind of a clearish sort of color, which, again, was really good for light bars. I had those printed, but the big challenge at the time was to convince my boss that this was worthwhile because no one had ever done this kind of thing before, right? Like this was brand new, especially in kind of the small to mid-sized business world. And so I finally had to convince him. I said, hey, we could save so much in design changes if by doing this. And so, yeah, lo and behold, we printed it out and they sent us the lenses within a week, which I was astounded by. I was able to put them on as a fit check tool to ensure that design was working appropriately. And at that time, I was like, this is a game changer. This is a technology that I need to be using more often. It did save some time. I did some design changes, and then we were able to successfully have that part injection molded. And so, you know, I felt like, wow, this is incredible. So I was blown away by the technology. I was enamored with it from the beginning. And then I started looking around. I was going to night school at the time, getting my MBA. And you know, I was looking around at sort of other opportunities. I worked in this design engineering function for a while. And then I noticed locally at Boeing in St. Louis had an opportunity for someone to come in and work in their rapid prototyping lab. And I was, first of all, I was amazed that there was even another company using this technology locally. And Boeing was just starting to develop it at the time. And so it was a rapid prototyping lab. I came into that group and then I was hired into that group. I had the fortunate kind of the stars aligned, you know, and I came into this team and then I was like, wow, the stereolithography, the machines are right here. You know, this is amazing. And then, oh, by the way, there's SLS, there's FDM, you know, and now all of a sudden, like my eyes started opening into this whole world of rapid prototyping. This was about 2000. So it was about 20 years ago. This is 2004. It just sort of just became my thing, right? And so then I've been working in that field ever since. I've really enjoyed having the exposure on the polymer side as well as the metal side as well. So it really sort of changed my career, changed my life, and you know, I'm incredibly grateful for how that all started.
Okay. I'm assuming all the stuff at Boeing was polymer when you were there.
It was mostly polymer. Although there was a very early RCAM, like one of the very first RCAMs that kind of existed. I think it was like serial number 3 or something like that. It was there as well. So it came a little later, a couple of years after I first joined into that team. That was an impressive technology, especially at the time too.
And what did you, so the check fit thing is actually, it's kind of cool. We haven't really talked about that. That was like, but actually for a lot of people, that is one of the first things they did eventually, right? What are some of the other things? I know maybe you can't be too specific about certain things, but what are some of the other things you were doing at the time? Like let's say about 15 years ago, like with additive at the time, prototypes, what are the tooling, that kind of thing?
Or? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of the things that you see now is kind of like run of the mill, commonplace, any of the jigs, fixtures, tooling, work being, you know, done SLS and both FDM. We found that FDM at the time worked a little bit better for tooling and fixturing just due to the kind of the robustness. But then if you needed encapsulated geometries that allowed, you know, cavities to be removed, then obviously sort of SLS fit the bill for that. So having the different technologies and kind of comparing them and navigating them to the appropriate application was kind of commonplace. And again, this was 20 years ago. So it's kind of interesting now to reflect back on that and see people saying, hey, use FDM for jigs and fixtures. Like it's brand new. It, it isn't. It's been done for like a long period.
I was gonna say, is that the only reason you had it back then for Jason Fixture?
No, there was actually
prototyping and pure prototyping, not like going to production prototyping. But you know
well, yeah, the Jason Fixture was obviously that's how it kind of became well known and kind of proliferated within the community within all of the engineering teams. But, you know, there was also, you know, there were actually production parts being made as well on SLS, you know, for ECS ducts. This is published knowledge. You can go back and, you know, look at all of the articles. So, you know, we were actually using it for production too, way back then. So specs had to be written around that technology. A lot of the, you know, trying to get in and understanding all the different parameters on how they can be manipulated to get different sort of mechanical properties that all need to be done. So we were at the time, the team I was on was kind of working on running design of experiments on these types of technologies. And then from the outcome of those design of experiments, integrating those into specifications for flight hardware. So specifically around SLS way back then, it's all been, you know, it's all kind of gravitated and scaled to multiple different aircraft at this point, but that's sort of how it all sort of started. So the jigs and fixtures and the wind tunnel models, for example, out of SLA were kind of the standard, you know, parts that kind of came out of the lab. But then there was also this initiative on productionizing, you know, sort of SLS for those ECS ducts. And again, this is all public knowledge. You can go back and look at
it. So this ECS ducting thing was, it's the most logical business case in the world. But and it grew immensely, right? I mean, we're talking like almost every Boeing commercial aircraft, I think, if not every, and a lot of other military stuff as well. And a lot of this this environmental control ducting, right? That's just, it was really complicated tubing. So it seems super obvious, but do you have any more information about how it came about? Because if you look at it, it's like, oh, it's super obvious because it's this really kind of windy tube thing that goes from the toilet up or whatever. And you would need like 19 parts to make it out of a mold.
Right.
And yeah, just making it one. It seems like, you know, just so obvious, but to get there, I think it would be a bit different, you know?
It was, because you have to kind of flash back and think about the way things were 20 years ago, right? These newer technologies like this were just relatively seen as completely unknowns. And when you have a whole culture, and you know, again, I talk about this in my book quite a bit about the culture and the adoption of change within the culture at that time, especially, was incredibly conservative. So any kind of new technology, you know, had to be looked at very, very critically in terms of like, what can it do? Like, where can it go wrong? How can it fail? And so that's why a lot of that spec development was incredibly critical back in the day. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you look at that geometry now and you're like, this is a perfect case for SLS. Back then, it was actually more of a motivation of supply chain problems. So again, chaos creates, you know, innovation in many cases. So if you have a supply chain shortage of conventionally manufactured ECS ducts, that can be a really good way to generate interest in, you know, exploring other manufacturing alternatives. And so that became basically the way that that technology earned its way, you know, onto the aircraft.
Yeah. And we're talking like, well, officially 20, like officially it's always been said like 20,000, 30,000 parts, whatever. But if we do the math a little bit, we know it's much, much larger than this. So I think it's a really wonderful thing. And do you have any advice for somebody? Because there are people trying to do the same thing, like in a relatively conservative engineering organization, introduce a new technology. Do you have any advice for people doing the same thing? Don't do it. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Don't do it.
Yeah. Do you value your career? Don't do it. No, it's amazing to, you know, I've kind of seen this happen now over several different years of kind of exploring the space. And a lot of this is really, it comes down to resistance to change. Within the company, and it kind of, you have to kind of feel that out, like what's sort of the appetite for change within your company culture. There'll always be a chief engineer that will, you know, sort of try to roadblock it because it's a lot easier to say no than yes to newer technologies. And so that's, you know, that's always going to be there. So you have to kind of feel out, okay, who are sort of the champions who are on my side of this technology that can see the true return on investment, the true benefits in terms of value of weight reduction or cost. And you know, you kind of are spearheading this movement internally to change. So you kind of map out the champions, and then you start taking a look at, okay, now sort of who are the roadblocks? Who are the people that it's a lot easier for them to say no than yes? How much data do they need to be able to, you know, make them say yes? Or is there an alternative path to get, you know, qualified parts flying? So you kind of have to kind of map it out. And then you look at, okay, now what has to happen within the culture to get this to change? At the highest levels, who are the executive sponsors that can drive down the change? Who are the folks that can really kind of implement either budget to make it happen, or you know, some tie it to some sort of existing cost reduction initiative within the company, or somebody who can, you know, really explore the space and become that executive champion that becomes kind of the advocate to rally everyone around. You kind of need to have that too. So you sort of have to have a good combination of folks that are kind of on your side to help sort of drive these. If you don't, any one of those, if you don't have them in place, could, you know, can obviously derail any kind of these improvements. Luckily now, though, I think you can go back and see what has been done over the past 20 years, and you can use that, you know, as examples. Like, you know, competitor A has, you know, implemented this 10 years ago, and it's, you know, flying in space, and competitor B uses it for, you know, for these types of applications, and our application is quite similar. So you can, enough work has been done now over the past 20 years, so it may make it a little easier, but you'll always have those people internally resisting change.
I think, yeah, it's always like when I've seen 3D printing projects go wrong, it's always change management, or literally what you said, like one person saying, yeah, this is going to make my job a havoc and cost me everything, or, you know, it's not going to be anything meaningful for me. So yeah, you know what? Guess what? I'll say no. Right. So I think that's a really good, I think it seems like a really solid approach. I mean, I've just seen this fail a long time. And I think this is one interesting thing you touched on, and like, yeah, there's so much going on, but there was so much going on for a long time, but no one shared it. Right. So the importance of sharing, like, for example, one momentous moment for me was when NASA started publishing stuff about the baby Bantam and Aerojet Rocketdyne, all these projects it was doing. And here was NASA saying these things were equal to cast and forged parts. And they were saying, oh, this is 80 parts. And now we're going to 3, you know? And then all of a sudden it was out there and everyone could talk about it. And before that, everyone like was able to talk about it internally, but no one could share it. So there wasn't enough ammunition to really get people to adopt the technology.
Right. Yeah. And I think going back, and if I look at sort of the presentations that I gave, you know, at various different conferences back in the day, they were more geared toward tooling and fixturing and things like that. Like, it wasn't necessarily around, you know, how to implement internally for, you know, process certification, flight certification, or anything like that, because that's IP. All that IP those companies held, they paid a lot of money for that intellectual property protection. And so at that time, this is a new technology. They felt it as a, you know, a brand new field that they're exploring, and they invested a lot of time and money in the people and the technology and all of the mechanical property data, which costs a fortune, by the way, especially on the metallic side. Fatigue data, for example, takes enormous amounts of cost. And so, you know, there's a huge investment by a lot of these major companies. And so they see it as like, okay, this is our IP. We've paid for it. Let's not go out and just, you know, tell it to the world. And it took a company like NASA, like you said, who is more of a public facing company, to kind of bring in, you know, bring it to the spotlight. And they even wrote their own kind of process specifications, which, you know, many people have downloaded now for metallic powder beds specifically. And that was a big game changer, right? Because now, oh, look, this is the sort of secret sauce that you can use to create these metal powder parts. This was a lot of, you know, the big contractors, aerospace contractors, had already sort of done this internally years before, but they were never allowed to share it. So I think you're right. I mean, that was kind of a monumental moment where they were able to kind of release this out to the public, and people were able to kind of jump on it.
So if you got involved at Boeing in 2000, whatever, the logical thing, the smart thing, if you're really, really smart, would have been, you know, you close them up to the Phantom Works guys. The drone boom is happening. So a quarter of the SLS machines in North America are printing drone parts. Everybody in every service wants, the Coast Guard wants a left-handed drone or whatever, right? And then you could have just done that, right? You just said, oh, I know a little bit about the ECX ducting thing. I can make you a fuel tank, right? But then instead you decided to go for metal printing. Why?
Exactly.
Why would you do this?
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
Because it's cool.
It's cool. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a fair question. No one's ever asked me that question before. That's pretty fair. I had done the Polymer thing for about 6 years at that point, and you know, it was very interesting. Obviously, I got to explore the space, SLS, FDM. At the time, I was also, you know, I was going to more graduate school, and I was learning more around kind of on the metallic side. And within the same building, actually, there was an advanced metallics team. So it wasn't a big stretch, right? That means I go to the metallics team. It's like literally the opposite side of the building. So I just walked to change jobs and move to the metallics group. And the metallics team was doing a lot of research, and they still do a tremendous job researching, you know, advanced machining practices, diffusion bonding, superplastic forming, like rotary friction welding, like all of these advanced joining techniques that the aerospace community typically enjoys. And then they were exploring, obviously, additive from the metallic standpoint. And so there was a big program that was happening at the time that I saw a really good opportunity with. And so I kind of moved into that space. And I started gaining a tremendous amount of knowledge on the metallic side, specifically Bloom Powder DED at the time. And then at that point, Boeing had sort of evolved internally on the metallics front. And then they started looking at opportunities on the powder bed side as well. And then at that point, they said, well, we can start bringing in all the sort of these additive metals machines, but that's going to cost a fortune. If we have to buy, six different types of all of the different AM metals machines that existed at the time, and you'd have to go in and sort of study all those, or we could, form an agreement. And so, working with Oak Ridge National Labs was a tremendous opportunity. At that point, then with my career, I kind of moved to Oak Ridge National Labs and started working with those guys because they were truly the experts in additive metal powder bed. And so, so then I moved there. I was a Boeing person at Oak Ridge National Labs. And so, that was a tremendous opportunity for me, and I really enjoyed it.
And talk to us a little bit about this blown powder DED kind of stuff, because we are seeing, I think a lot of people like DED is kind of like always the little ugly stepsister, It's like metal cheese whiz. It's kind of cool. It's cheap, but it's not like the prime time stuff. And all the cool people all about the cool powder diffusion parts. But I like blown DED. I like all the DED stuff, really, like except for WAMP. But I think it's super cheap, and I think it can be used a lot for structural parts or stuff like that. And yeah, there needs to be a lot of machining. But I think it's a technology that really, I think people don't realize how long people have been working on it, first off. And I don't think people really realize how advantageous it could be for our future, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. You're right. It isn't as sort of sexy, I suppose, because it's the geometric freedom isn't there for the DED compared to say the powder bed metal. And so it doesn't get a lot of headlines because of that. You don't see incredible topology optimized blown powder DED parts at scale or something like it's. But at the same time, it does have enough geometric complexity to be able to be dangerous in terms of being able to build parts that you still can't build conventionally. And so it finds a really nice niche with a lot of the kind of aerospace companies to be able to build larger structure that obviously the powder beds even today still struggle with, or if they do have a powder bed that large, just lifting like a massive amount of powder. Say, for example, like Inconel, like say you filled an entire powder bed machine that was like, 10 foot by 10 foot by 10 foot full of Inconel. Can you imagine how much weight that is that you're trying to like move? the system scale for powder bed is to scale larger and larger is a much tougher challenge than it is for, say, blown powder or wire fed EDM or, wire fed DED systems. Those systems kind of navigate to scale a little bit more for very large structure. Whereas the powder beds typically, try to stay more on the smaller-ish scale. That's changing, of course, now, but that's specifically how it was back then. So those blown powder DED systems provide a tremendous advantage. You can go quickly. You can do some novel things by doing a, kind of a hybrid approach like DMG Mori does, where they have, a cutter kind of come in and clean up those sides and, make really nice smooth surfaces that you can't maybe achieve in other ways. You know, there's a lot of really innovative aspects of that technology. And for companies that are trying to build really large AM parts that, that you know, can prove advantages over large castings, for example, or large machining, then yeah, it's a great advantage.
Yeah, I really think one thing I really want to see more of is people just combining it too. Because like blown powder, I mean, just other DED, like the Melteo process, all this stuff, you can just stick stuff to it so easily. So like just combining different, like combining, making a really accurate, like small powder infusion part, sticking it to the larger DED part, mm-hmm. maybe then cladding it with a different material. I would love to see more of these combo things that we know are going on in, like, you know, in jet engines and stuff, but I would like to see more of them in more prosaic applications as well, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's a great call out. You know, one of the things that I always try to do when I look at these kind of technologies as they kind of mature is like, what are we doing in the CNC industry or the machining industry or for composites in the, you know, carbon fiber layup, you know, massive autoclave kind of world, right? They like, I always try to like look at conventional manufacturing technologies and compare it to AM, and it still shows where AM is kind of in its infancy. I've kind of seen the industry now over the past 20 years kind of grow up from like an infant where, you know, everyone was really excited about it. They tossed a bunch of money at it. You know, everyone was enamored with kind of the toddler, and everyone kind of enjoyed the technology to a point where maybe a little too much, frankly, where, you know, the SPACs were involved and a lot of VC money was coming in. And now I think the industry is kind of at a point where it's like a teenager who's like in an identity crisis, right? Where it's like, who am I going to be when I grow up? You know, looking at himself in the mirror with pimple faced and everything. And like, who am I going to be? Like, how do I grow? And, you know, my parents are going to kick me out of the house soon enough. The money drain is going to end. How am I going to shift into a true production standard? And so if you go back and look at the conventional technologies for manufacturing, and you kind of compare that to where AM is, there's still a ways to go. To your point, you know, can you integrate DED and powder bed metal, and, you know, maybe even some sort of like direct write with electronics, like all in sort of the same sort of packaging? Why do we have to put them in different machines? Why does it have to be with you know, a variety of different kind of fabrication modalities when we can look at integration of a single kind of solution? I mean, if you look at like a CNC mill, for example, you know, I think one of your, I think it was the Dendrite guy that you had at the AM Summit, you know, he made a really, I wrote it down, it was a good quote where he was talking about, we don't run CNC machines at the same speeds and feeds. Like, that you wouldn't even, that's not even heard of. So why do we do it with AM? Like, it's really kind of a profound statement.
I want it
like,
faster. But yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Like, you know, so like, that's a really good call out there, because we shouldn't, right? We should be able to, the CNC.
Right. CNC has been acceptable for years, and it's been around for a very long time, and it's acceptable that it runs at that speed. Why isn't 3D printing acceptable at that speed? It's a good question. Like, why do we have to keep pushing it faster and faster?
Well, yeah, no, he was meaning more of like the CNC industry doesn't run at one speed all the time. It's running several different feeds and speeds constantly. And so why do we have like one set of parameters for the metal powder bed, for example? Like, why do we have like one parameter set that says at this speed, at this hash spacing, at this wattage, you're going to get your optimized part? Is that really true? When you produce your part in metal powder bed, should not the speeds and feeds and, you know, equivalent for AM metal, so the lasers and the hash spacing and everything, should that not also vary as you're growing your part to be able to optimize for different features on your structure, for example? Like, why are we not doing something like that? Kind of akin to the CNC industry.
Do we not understand it well enough?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Enough that we're building.
Or no, the run differences of the machines are too large, so we couldn't do that. That's also another one, right?
Yeah.
Right. And then how do you qualify the part now as well? Because you've added yet another variable into this whole thing. And it's like, it wasn't moving fast enough, and therefore it deposited too much material in that location, or it was running too fast and it didn't deposit enough material in that location.
Right. So then now they're kind of relying on AI to solve that problem, right? Well, AI will kind of come in and tell us how it needs to change the laser, how it needs to change the scan speed, how it needs to do all of this sort of, how it needs to change layer heights at different increments and things like that. Like, why are we running the same layer height the whole height?
Like, that's as long as is after if it fails, that the AI, since it's now a teenager 3D printer, can say some, you know, very teenager thing like, "You just don't understand."
And then spits the part out at you. "You just don't get it.
You don't get me."
Yeah, you don't get me as a printer.
Okay. Yeah, and then so I think that's a really, really valid point. I think it's going to be very difficult to get that maturity if we don't get. That's why I do like what the is it Ford AM or AM Ford? I keep getting them both confused. It's really annoying. But anyway, that's the whole idea of like qualifying more processes and getting people to work together. And I know that manufacturers are working on more, you know, ironing out the differences between run to run. You know, I think it is yeah, I think it's a good point. It's a good call to call this like a maturity issue, because it is totally, I think, a maturity thing. We will get there. And I think also it is until fairly recently, we were doing 100 machines a year, right? As a whole industry, like in 2000, like 15 years ago or something. And most of those machines are going to college professors. And the college professors just wanted to just, I want more options, right? I want more settings. I want to, you know, I want to put, you know, beryllium in it. I don't know, right? They wanted just more options, right? So that's, I think it's a fairly recent thing that somebody's like, no, I want to do it all the same thing all the time, you know? There's even a bigger question, I think, is like, well, you know, now we're making machines to make lots of different parts at the same time, right? In lots of different materials. But in the future, I don't want that, right? I mean, I just want to print the same part over and over again with some of my machines. You know, I'm just going to make pipes, or I'm just going to make like a pressure vessel. So why would I want a machine that looks like it's good enough for most geometries? No, I'm going to be making a pressure vessel of approximately 10 to 50 centimeters all over and over again, you know? So I want something optimized for that one goal, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I ultimately, one day, I don't even care what machine it was even built on, frankly, if I'm the customer, right? If I go to the local UPS store and I, you know, want somebody to scan something or copy something for me, I don't care what copy machine it was printed on. I don't ask the guy behind the counter, "Hey, was that a, you know, was that a Xerox?"
Right. Is it an Epson or an HP?
What was that? Like, I really want to know. Like, did you, like, what toner setting did you put that on? Was that a 50% toner setting? Or was that like a 30? Like, I really need to know this, because it, like, at the end of the day, ultimately one day down the road, I don't even want to know. I just want to know, does the part, you know, solve the objective function of that it needs to do? Like, is the part strong enough? Is it going to pass any kind of, you know, structural requirements that it needs to have? Is it going to, you know, be able to have the traceability and you know, all the things that kind of come with it? I just need to know that it has that. I don't need to know all of the other details. So that's ultimately, I think, where we should be striving to get to. But right now, because we are sort of a teenager, we're kind of enamored with all of the different options of all the different machines and all of the different material systems and all of the different strategies. And it needs to change. It kind of become, you know, production hardened. To a point where the maturity of the whole technology kind of needs to get to something that's more commonplace.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. I think it's also one interesting thing to link back to your journey, let's say, is that, you know, we all always, one of the things that people always keep saying is that, first off, it's about the education, it's about teaching people, and then always the reflexive kind of new generation of engineers will make everything happen, right? And you did use your Oak Ridge knowledge to implement like a training program for Boeing, right? For additive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was something that, you know, Boeing was big on at the time. I'm sure they still are. You know, it's about training the next sort of generation of design engineers that kind of come into the company. You know, Boeing has, you know, a lot of obviously employees that kind of come in fresh out of school, and a lot of them sort of needed to be taught about what can AM really do. It's not just the 3D printer that you may have had at your university, but hey, there's a whole big, broader sense of industrial machines and, you know, kind of the nuances between the metals and the polymers, for example. So kind of a whole training class had been, you know, developed that I'd put together and, you know, did some of the teaching on, but it became so popular that everyone started, you know, every manager sort of kind of putting it on their professional development plan for every one of the new hires. So then it became incredibly popular. And so then, you know, it had to be almost outsourced so that more people could enjoy learning about the technology. And And then also then when I came at Honeywell, it was more of the sort of same thing. They're like, oh, you do design teaching seminars for AM. Oh, you know, we sort of like that too. So, you know, it kind of like sort of moving on to kind of another, it takes kind of its own route and becomes its own initiative. You know, fast forward a few years, there are obviously companies that just do that, right, as their job. And so, you know, so I think that's been a nice, nobody really probably talks about that much, but that's been kind of a nice maturation of the technology to see as well, is that all that kind of training doesn't have to be done internally anymore. Now there are outside sources that can provide that information at probably cheaper rates and more effectively. So, yeah, that the educational aspect has definitely grown over the past few years.
Well, there's still more needs to be done. I was looking at some friend of mine wanted like a really cheap one. Somebody else wanted a really short one. There's just not, you know, there's like some programs out there like MIT one and all this, but there's not that many. The Barnes one with Purdue and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was thinking more of the Barnes one when I was saying that there's now some out there.
Yeah. and so they have option, but not for everyone, you know. So I think there still is a scope to do more. But and then another interesting thing I think is with this thing. So that's like the advent of this the modern mystery language, the language of the gods, DFAM, right? Which is its own little cult, right? Of people who we know DFAM and the other one don't. A little bit about DFAM.
Yeah, so DFAM. So I sort of take a exception to the naming convention of DFAM because everyone sort of applies DFAM to mean a lot of different things. And we sort of faced this when we were in Honeywell, when you know, sort of a lot of different people within the company was like, oh, we need to DFAM this, and we need to DFAM this. But when we actually started asking them, what does that mean? Their intention with their question was vastly different. So then we sort of started to separate things into MFAM and DFAM. And this was kind of important, where MFAM was where you would take a design and you would modify it to be additively manufactured. So you would add some chamfers to eliminate support material, or you would orient the part so that it could, you know, to minimize the need for supports, or you would do, you know, some sort of modification, and maybe you would add like a flange or a feature to it to again kind of minimize supports and make it build faster, or perhaps you would do, you know, something else to orient it to a position where you know it will have the best strength for that orientation. And so that became kind of an MFAM, or what we classified as modified for additive. DFAM, on the other hand, we reserved more for thinking of the design from the beginning, from the blueprint definition. So kind of toss out in your mind from a design perspective the way that this part already has been or already has been fabricated for the past several years or decades even, and kind of conceive differently if you had AM in your toolbox. And now how could you design? So then this gets more on, you know, closer to more of kind of the topology optimization aspect, where you're defining load paths and then structure is being created due to the load paths, where you're you know, this is now more efficient planning in kind of that design profile. And then you're looking at how that particular part now can integrate into the next part, and why do they have to be two different parts now? And so, you know, now so that's more of what I like to call DFAM. I think people still refer to MFAM as DFAM, and it's a bit of a terminology mismatch, just from my perspective, but that's kind of how I sorted it out. And the reason why it's kind of important is because the amount of money and qualification effort to address an MFAM problem is vastly different than a DFAM problem. And so that's why it's kind of been separated.
Yeah, I think it's really suspect that DFAM is now the default term, and the other term has completely disappeared, and no one talks about it. It's just the same thing, and I'm like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. So then now then that requires somebody to ask qualifying questions, like, what do you mean by DFAM, right? Now everyone, somebody has to do that.
And then do you have any more advice for like, let's say I would want to teach a large organization, like a DFAM skill set, let's say. You said, okay, there's external sources and stuff like that. It's good to do it internally. But do you have any kind of like ideas of like what should that curriculum, or maybe even broader, like additive manufacturing broader, I think. What are some things that you would include or definitely include, or things you don't see included as much as you would like to see included?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think a lot of it just gets down to design principles in general. So I would just start there. A lot of designers who kind of come into these companies, you know, they've been taught sort of how to do mechanical engineering, of course, at the university. But then when they come into the company, the parts already exist. These designs have been around for many, many years. Or, you know, they look at existing product lines and they're like, wow, these haven't really changed a whole lot. This is what it looks like. So they're already sort of predisposed to begin thinking about design from the standpoint of, well, this is what our products have already been, and this is how they've been manufactured for years. And so you kind of want to break that. You want to break that from the beginning. And the newer hires, it's much easier to do than the people that have been in the company for like 20, 30 years, who have been designed for manufacturing, like has been ingrained into their head where I can't design this, you know, unless it can be machined or unless it can be injection molded, or they have some sort of already thought process that is kind of embedded into their brain from a design perspective. Those people are a lot harder to convert to the AM world than maybe some of the fresher students out of the university. So my advice would be to kind of start with just basic design principles first, and kind of grow from there. So I know that, like, for example, EOS Additive Minds does a great job with this, where, you know, they go in and they do a really kind of design think, where, you know, they kind of go in and really kind of understand the design space and really kind of go through design exercises from the beginning. Before you're even talking anything about additive, you're just thinking about the design space and how it can open up from the beginning. And it's where you're trying to drive more to that DFAM that I talked about earlier. And so that's a big component, and that's a huge component. From there, then ultimately, then you have to kind of start covering the polymers. And then you have to start covering the metallic side of things. And, you know, just like, here's the space of the technologies that we currently have. And then advanced, you know, I wouldn't stop there either. Advanced, newer, lower technology readiness level technologies like, you know, ceramics and also, you know, sort of direct write, where the electronics work as well. You can cover some of that too. Like, so now they have sort of, these are the tools that you have. These are the machines that are available. These are the materials that they all run. And that in itself is a really, that's a lot of information. So that we're talking about many, many, many hours just to get kind of that digested. Now, many of the design engineers, it's not like they need to use all of this information, but they need to be able to pick and sort which one to use at what time for their designs. Then at the end of that, then there's like a summary card of like, okay, now here's like a quick reference for, you know, when you go off two months from now and you're working on your design and you need to kind of reference, okay, which technology was that? Which material was that? So you kind of give them like a reference card system. And then beyond that, then you start looking into, okay, now I know a little bit about design. I now know a little bit about all of the technologies that are out there in the AM space and how they can affect the design. But then kind of what's in it to design it? Like, why should someone care to adopt this technology? So then you start looking at the economic benefits. Like, you start showcasing ROIs on, like, you know, when to buy a machine or when you should look at make versus buy on your design kind of portfolios. And then you start reviewing, how does this work? Like, when should I get a machine? When should I not get a machine? And then at this point, you then start becoming kind of more, I guess, synced up with kind of the space, the whole space of AM. And by this point, then you start looking at, okay, what's next? What's in the future? So then a whole section on upcoming technologies, you know, what's now being developed? Where will this technology be in 5-10 years from now? Should also be kind of be outlined. So basically, if you kind of combine all that together, you're talking like a week long, at least, effort to really kind of deliver the best sort of content, you know, for this technology. So that would be an example of just somebody that really needed to understand, from like a design engineer who really needed to understand this technology. But if you take, for example, maybe an executive within a company, do they need to go through all of that? No, they don't. They probably just need to understand the basics of the technology. And then they just need to understand the ROI aspect of it, maybe the economic analysis, some pieces there, and then maybe where it's going in the future. So you could have more of like a condensed set of curriculum for some executives and places and people like that. So I think it depends on the audience. And I found that by grouping the audience based on where they rank within the company and what their job function is, then you can kind of tailor that specific education package to them.
No, I think that's a good point. I think that's a great point. And so talk us a little bit about BADT, because that's a company that I love it. Yeah, you do product development for people, right? Well, first of all, you resell Ansys and stuff like this, right? And yeah. But also you can do product development. So it's a bit of a strange beast, let's say, right?
So BAT is a really interesting company. It's great to work for. We're celebrating our 30th year, actually, this year. 30 years, which is a big feat for our company. You're right. We sell Ansys, Stratasys, EOS, Zeiss, in terms from the hardware perspective. But that's just one third of our business, basically. We also have a whole team dedicated to using these tools. So we have a whole dedicated group that acts as kind of a service bureau of all of the hardware, for example. We have a whole dedicated team of people who use the Ansys software to be able to, you know, to be able to help customers to learn to teach them how to use it. To help them, you know, after the software is sold to them. So we have experts in all of these areas. We don't just sell all of these equipment and kind of let the customer go off and experience it on their own. We have expertise in all of these technologies and because we use them ourselves. So one of the rules is here is that we don't ever try to sell any piece of software or hardware that we don't know how to use ourselves and we're not experts in. So we have deep expertise and on the software side as well as the hardware side. In addition to that, we also have engineering services as well, which you mentioned too, like product development, product design. So we have a whole group that just does nothing but, you know, help companies, help startups, help whomever with developing whole products for them. So from the design phase all the way through to completion.
Is there a specialty you guys are focused on or something? I mean, like, could I come to you if I really want the new whoopee cushion?
There's a lot. He's being really polite. They're more Taguchi than Tamagotchi.
Yeah. That's what exactly.
But I think BAT, I don't know what you guys are allowed to say, but you did work well. Like for example, if you would like some engineering done on a spacecraft,
yeah,
or
absolutely.
An artificial lung or a heart or something like that, these are the guys to go through, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. The breadth of different applications that I see here. It's like, you know, one day you could be talking to a customer who does, you know, healthcare, a med device sort of company. And then, you know, the next day it's a major aerospace company. The next day it's an automotive company. We help everyone across the board, basically.
And imagine I'm a big company and I want to outsource this engineering of this component. Because I think not a lot of people think of starting that way, right? And what I almost always notice in clients is that they buy machines too early, right? Mm-hmm. So they go and they're like, oh, we need to make this thing, so let's buy a metal printer, right? That's what?
Right.
So, and it's like, oh, let's spend the next 2 years using it and blowing like $2 million on it. And
We're going all in.
Yeah, exactly. And then they end up having the wrong machine. It's like, it's like, oh, you should have thought of E-beam, you know? It's like, oh. No, we didn't really know that the E-beam was there when we bought this one. Talk to us a little bit about using an outsourcing partner to do that product development. Because a lot of people may be a bit hesitant because of like the IP stuff or that they're not learning or that, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what we found is that, you know, a lot of sort of companies, you know, engage with us for a number of reasons. Number one, it could be, you know, maybe they have too much work that their workforce can't do at the moment. So it's kind of like an overflow sort of situation. So that's kind of one route. Another route though is like specialty, right? They don't have the time and ability to like ramp up a whole team that's dedicated to nothing but Ansys. But we know that maybe there's going to be a lot of software simulation in this project. How can we solve this problem? So you know, PAT is there to sort of solve that problem. Or for example, we want to try additive manufacturing, but we don't really have the capital expense budget to go buy a machine yet. Can we try a few parts? And oh yeah, by the way, PAT provides the ability to not only to build the parts, but also the ability to maybe MFAM or DFAM, right? Your parts before they're even printed. So you're sort of adding value from that perspective. Hey, have you thought about from the design standpoint doing this? Have you thought about this? Don't forget, additive can do this. So kind of, you know, teaching the customer maybe about the technology that maybe they hadn't thought of that perspective before. So that's another example of how we can kind of, you know, help customers add value to their products. There's a number of different ways that we help. It's quite astounding, honestly, how this company grew up 1994 from basically, you know, our owners a really funny story real quick is that they were trying to start this company. They were ex-Honeywell engineers. One of the engineers, Ray Chu, whom you may know, he's a brilliant guy. He started working on the stereolithography machine way back in Honeywell, way back in the day, really conceived that, way back in 1994 timeframe, but even before that. He wanted to start a company doing just this work. No one really knew what stereolithography was back to way early in this conversation at that time. And so he was able to convince a bank, basically locally here in Phoenix, to basically lease for $250,000. You know, the company was less than 12 months old at the time. And so, but they were able to convince them to do it. The bank was like, well, what is stereolithography? How does this work? But they were able to do it. And then they started like in a local machine shop, and then it just gravitated, got larger, more machines were acquired, more technologies, more software was added. So it just kind of just grew. So now we're at year 30 of this journey, and it's been a fantastic, a fantastic journey.
And you guys are also you decided to become ITAR registered just for the fun of it. You like forums a lot, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, there's a lot there too. Obviously, we do. ITAR registration was huge because that allows us to work with the defense side heavily. So, which we do. A lot of SBIR work, comes in into our company as well. So there is obviously that protection's there for those kind of. Those kind of customers, and that's really we differentiate there quite heavily compared to a lot of other sort of channel partners and resellers in this space.
Yeah, totally. You guys got a ton of SBIR stuff. I mean, on biomimicry and like all this other kind of flow regulation devices of some kind, that kind of stuff. Do you have any advice for a company? Because I know if for a startup, I know that startups get SBIR stuff as well, and young companies as well. Like especially lately, NASA and other funders have been kind of more adventurous, I think, than do you have any advice on getting these SBIR grants? Because it is for a young company, it can be a huge, really beneficial, beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. In PADT, we have the people to help you through that process. So we have whole teams of people that can help guide companies in that process it can be quite cumbersome. It can be quite daunting, frankly, like you said, these kind of a startup trying to navigate the world of SBIRs and STTRs and whatnot. So we have a number of industry partners, obviously, that we work with. ASU being here local, Arizona State University is huge. We work with them quite heavily. And then so we have kind of the academic reach outs as well if we want to get into kind of the early, low kind of embryonic research in the space. But we also have obviously partners as well within the more industrialized space. So we kind of can see the whole gamut of folks from academia all the way to industry, and then we can help that startup company understand kind of the process flow to get that to win that SBIR STTR.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. It's non-dilutive, and it's also prestigious as well, and it's also useful. It's not like kind of stupid. So it typically also maybe a lot of these things get used for some really, really exciting applications as well. So that's great advice. Hey, Dave, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation, guys. Like I love what you guys do. Keep putting out great content. I love listening to you guys. And thanks for having me. I'm honored to be on this call.
All right. And thank you, Max, for being here as well.
No, it was great. I love the, Boeing and Honeywell, all these guys. This was cool. Thank you, Joyce.
And and thank you for listening. This is another episode of the 3D Pod. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the 3D Pod. For more information on what you just heard or to subscribe, visit www.3dprint.com or follow us at 3dprint_com.